So we're well into winter retreat now, here in February. And again, coming together for afternoon and evening group practice, sitting, walking, meditation. Trying to settle the mind a bit, slow down. Watch things a bit more clearly. Thanh Nhất Sư Bồ brought up a point at the end of the evening talk, or not talk, but the reading that Ajahn Titipaño was doing just a short while ago, and brought up a comment, reflection question around samadhi, samasamadhi, and just bringing up for consideration how we hold that term, how it's interpreted, used, how we reflect on that, how it's experienced from a more conventional point of view, as it's often taught in the Theravada, towards maybe looking at a more expansive experience, as is described by some of the teachers in our tradition. So I thought I'd been thinking about maybe exploring that a bit, kind of reinforced that inclination. I thought maybe just to start with a very short sort of a guided meditation or reflection that I picked up from a recording of Ajahn Suchito a few years back, and I pick it up as kind of a way of starting a period of meditation sometimes. I find it very useful to help relax and broaden the entry into a particular meditation period, because so often we kind of go, we sit down, we bow, and then we get in our meditation posture, we close our eyes, and just as fast as we can barely blink an eye, the chatter starts, the obsession starts, the internal dialogue starts, and off we're going on a thought train. And can become quickly very pinched and difficult if we start out that way. Hard to kind of get back to something that's a little more useful, wholesome. So a way that Ajahn Suchito describes is, if the mind seems to be inclined towards complexity or proliferation, to try and open up a bit, is how I experience it anyway. He encourages people to just start out a little more simply and actually, and I'll just describe it more quickly than you would necessarily do it as a your own guided meditation, but just to give a flavor. And starting with the eyes open and not closed, at least in the beginning. And it's a way of starting to tune in a little bit to the sensory experience, sense bases, with the visual field being a starting place, so that one can keep one's eyes open gently, not gazing too far off into the distance, and not focusing on, say, a particular person, but finding a comfortable place to rest the eyes on an object, a place on the floor in front of you, or if you're sitting behind somebody, you could maybe gently focus on the back part of their body, or some other object within the you know, comfortable visual field, and just to keep one's eyes open for a minute and allow the visual focus to fall on that particular area. And then to notice the full visual field so that the focus is relaxed on that object and allowed to broaden into the entire visual field, the peripheral vision, objects that are in the upper part or the lower part of the visual field, the left visual field, the right visual field, just allowing the attention to broaden and open up to the entire visual field. And getting a sense of how that softens, maybe even allowing the eyes to unfocus. And just to notice the difference in the quality of mind there. You know, what is it like to have the eyes open and allowing full visual field, but not to be hard focused on any one particular object. Just to relax that attention to a very broad field, visual activity. Just to be with that for a moment. Then to notice the quality, to let the actual objects in the visual field soften even more, and to step back and notice the quality of the awareness itself, the quality of visual consciousness, if you want to call it that, but just that sense of the knowing of this broad, soft visual field. There's a quality of being alert to it, of knowing it, of being conscious of it. And then when it's comfortable in your own practice time, when you're doing it on your own, to then softly, gently let the eyes close and shift the focus of attention to the hearing. And again, allowing yourself to attend to maybe the most prominent sound that's in the room that you're in. In this case, it might be the sound of my voice, the words that I'm saying. And when those moments in between my words are happening, where there's silence, the sound of water dripping on the roof, and then again, relaxing that field of auditory experience, broadening that to allow perception of all of the possible sounds that might come in through the ear. Distant sound of water running in a stream. Maybe some background hiss of the microphone system. And you can even broaden that to say the sound of silence, if you have used that as an object of meditation, that subtle sound of the inner ear, the inner listening, the inner sound, but not excluding any one sound. So broad listening. And similarly, noticing the awareness of that, the consciousness, or conscious awareness of that of those sounds, of that listening quality. And then change your focus to, say, the qualities of the thinking mind. You can notice when a thought arises. You see its content. Maybe the mind is quite quiet now, but if you wait long enough, a thought's going to pop up there probably. Or you can deliberately think a thought. Notice the space in between them, in between a thought and the next one. And just allow the mind to step back for a moment, relax in the space. Separating the knowing from the actual thought itself. And then switching to the object, the body, this physical body. Noticing where the most prominent sensation is, say, in where the sitting bones are touching the cushion or the chair or the bench, or the legs on the ground. And relaxing that focus a bit, feeling the whole body if you can. Muscles of the face, slight movements, the whole body, in and out breathing. Pains, obstructions, or areas of relaxation. But relax the focus from one spot to the entire body. And allow the perception to arise of just there is a body. And experience the pure knowing of that, just the fact that there is also this aspect of our experience that just knows the tactile sensation of this body. So this is just a bit of an exercise that one can do to enter into a period of meditation. It helps broaden, loosen one's awareness and can prevent that kind of entry into kind of tight, narrow, and possibly, you know, proliferative meditative experience. I have found that quite useful in developing a sense of peace and clarity and a broad experience. So, thinking a bit of the topic of Samma Samadhi, and it's probably a dangerous place to go. There's so many teachings and opinions and interpretations of the teachings around that, and the suttas and the commentaries and the commentaries on the commentaries and the present-day experience of various teachers and various traditions. And sometimes it gets into debates and disagreements. I used to refer to them as jhana wars, as people would expound differently on what it means to them or how they interpret it or how to approach it. So it's with a little bit of hesitation that I say a few words. I won't claim to have very much scholarly knowledge, it's a an area that keeps unfolding for me in different ways, and I find different ways of understanding and experiencing little bits of this part of the Noble Eightfold Path. So I'll put all my disclaimers out there right up front so that nobody holds me to anything, and I'm not claiming any kind of expertise at all, just offering a few thoughts. Kind of following along the lines of how Tanisubo had opened it up earlier with the reflection that I have found very useful of understanding Sama Samadhi as a much more relaxed, open, broad kind of experience than what gets presented sometimes or how we hear about it sometimes. Maybe starting out for me anyway a little bit with what it isn't in my mind anymore, and maybe kind of what it started out with being many years ago when I was first entering into the practice, and perhaps others have picked this up along the way too, that many of the descriptions of it sounding like a very narrow, focused experience, concentration, just the word concentration as a translation of samadhi immediately brings forth for me an image of a very narrow, single-pointed kind of focus. The school teacher in my elementary school telling me over and over again how I'm too restless and I need to concentrate. I need to get down and concentrate on what I'm doing. And that kind of tight rigidity that comes from hearing that word. So I don't experience now what I experienced earlier in my practice in the early days of, I guess I don't believe anymore that, concentration is kind of a particular practice. You sometimes hear, it's like people might be going to practice samadhi or sometimes more generally practicing samatha versus practicing vipassana, that it's an actual technique. And I think that that's an unfortunate way of understanding samadhi. It's not, there's not a samadhi technique that one has to master. And similarly, one isn't picking up a specific technique in order to, even if it's not defined specifically as samadhi technique, it's a technique that will bring samadhi or find some samadhi or, purchase some samadhi, prepare the ground for one's getting a samadhi experience. You can sometimes enter into this whole realm of meditation practice, with this sense of, oh, my mind's a mess. I got to get me some samadhi. I just want to get me some samadhi. And you think maybe, kind of hold it in the way of, if I can just get enough in and out breaths in a row, then I'll be able to purchase some of that samadhi. It's almost like a commodity. 200 breaths in a row, and for sure, then I'll be able to cash that in for some samadhi. Even though it may not be quite that blatant, sometimes it can feel like that's what you're supposed to do. And sometimes I think, that the way that we hold that, or the way that it has been held and shared and taught as kind of a narrow, single-pointed focus, contributes more to a real tightness of mind than is what the Buddha was suggesting as sama samadhi. And I venture into a little bit of hazardous territory here because it gets into some of the terms and words, and I'm not an expert, but the word ekagata comes to mind as kind of a focal point for some of what seems to me to be a confusing interpretation of samadhi, and in that, we know that the factors of first jhana can be listed as vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, and then in some cases the fifth factor of ekagata. And again, not an expert, but knowing that it does appear as one of the first jhana factors in some of the suttas, but I don't think all that many. I know it's in one reference that when Sariputta is talking in the greater discourse on questions and answers, and he lists ekagata as one of the first jhana factors. But in most of the stock formulas, I believe, of jhana description, it's just those first four, vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, and ekagata is not always, in fact, most of the time, it's not part of that formulation. But nevertheless, it's made its way into the minds of many practitioners that's the fifth factor in the first jhana. And oftentimes it's translated as single-pointedness. So I think this is where a lot of the teachings around concentration of the breath at a very narrow point of focus, single-pointed, such as presented in a number of the teachings at the particularly like at the tip of the nose or at one very small place in the body, say in the abdomen and other traditions, but sort of the tip of the nose being a quintessential description of where you should place your single-pointed focus. Ekagata is often used in that way. And so other people, who don't experience that kind of single-pointed focus as being very useful very enriching for their practice, say, well, maybe a better translation would be unification or unity, such as the unification of the mind with the object of meditation. But then, to me, that kind of brings into conflict a little bit of the word in the second jhana that appears of ekodi bhavan, which then, if you've included ekagata in the first one, then as single-pointedness, then ekodi bhavan is often translated as unification of mind, which seems to make sense in terms of the word ekodi bhavan, sort of like bhava, development, single-pointed kind of, or unification with, one with, one with the object. So Ajahn Jeff, I think, teased it out once in some essay I read quite a while back, but if I remember correctly, he used more of a description of ekagata as, instead of single-pointed, more like singleness of purpose, which seemed to me to make a little bit more, be a bit more user-friendly, particularly if you consider unification within the second jhana as happening. But singleness of purpose, so that the whatever the object is chosen, that is chosen to put one's attention on, it's done with a wholehearted purpose to keep that particular focus in mind wholeheartedly. And that, to me, is quite user-friendly. So that, because we know that there's many objects that we can choose. It may not be the breath. Four foundations of mindfulness, the four establishings of mindfulness, allow for a wide range of objects to bring into our range of attention for reflection, for holding and examining. And if we do that with a singleness of purpose, then that leads to more of a state of open open calmness as we bring our attention into that field, no matter what it is. So I like that kind of approach for myself. It's interesting, too, because you can see that sometimes, you know, some people are actually quite good at that kind of narrow focus, excluding all sorts of data and input from the external world, from the other sense bases, shutting it off and focusing exclusively in a very narrow point of focus. Are able to almost create their own personal kind of sensory deprivation tank through a very exclusive way of attending to a narrow focus, and can attain a sort of form of concentration given the right circumstances. And it's dependent oftentimes on a very specific, refined set of circumstances, a quiet environment, not much distraction happening, not many responsibilities, not having to interact at all. So it has usually some fairly exclusive conditions that support it. But nevertheless, and some people can still do that with those supports. And to me, it seems like what's being attained is a fairly sterile kind of concentration. Ajahn Amaro used to refer to it as kind of like a shooting gallery. I sort of think of it as like shooting gallery samadhi, where, you know, at least in the old days, they had these kind of pinball-type machines where you have the little ducks coming up, traversing across the screen. You have your rifle, and you're shooting them down one by one, you know, getting rid of all the ducks until, you know, if you can get a perfect score, and then you've completely cleaned out any of the little ducks floating across the screen, and there's nothing left. So it's like this kind of shooting down every stray thought, every stray perception, everything coming in until you have this nice, pristine, clear, still mind. The problem is that it tends to be, seems like to me anyway, it tends to be based on aversion and wanting to annihilate and get rid of. And it kind of brings up in my mind too, because I've also been reading the Buddhist cosmology book by Ajahn Punadamo, that there's actually the perfection of that state of mind can possibly result in a rebirth in a certain realm called the Asanyasata realm, which is a realm that's actually very high up in the Brahmaloka. I think it's part of the fourth Brahmaloka realm. And it's kind of like a little suburban subdivision of that fourth realm, set aside for beings who have perfected the ability to shut out and eliminate the perceptions and thoughts that come into the mind through very strong, focused, narrow concentration, and they're able to essentially will themselves into unconsciousness, non-asanya-sata, kind of like a non-percipient being, sometimes referred to as an unconscious being. And the rebirth in that realm is, it's interesting because apparently, as it's described anyway in Ajahn Puna's book, a very beautiful realm, very lovely and pristine and jewel-laden and golden, and gardens that are perfect all the time, beautiful colors and shapes and forms, and it's the ultimate in beauty and pleasing environment, and that the bodies of the beings that are born into the realm are also similarly beautiful golden bodies. So it's an entirely pleasing, wonderful realm. But the problem is that the beings that are born into it based on this kind of meditation are completely unconscious right from the moment that they're born into it. And then they stay there kind of in suspended animation for 500 kapas, 500 eons of world expansion and contraction, and they're not subject to the contraction phase of the worlds below them. These are in realms that last beyond expansion and contraction periods. So they just stay there, and the length of this lifetime is said to be 500 of those kapas. And they're beautiful beings in a beautiful realm and completely unaware of it, not experiencing any bit of that at all. And then at the end of the lifespan of 500 eons, they're reborn in some other realm with absolutely no memory of this experience. It's completely unconscious. And Ajahn Puna relates it to what it might be like to just be under surgical anesthesia for that entire period of time. Because you go under anesthesia, have your operation, and you wake up and you have no memory, no recollection, it's just like experience stopped at one point and then picked up again right where you left off. So, 500 eons is a long time. And to be completely unconscious. So I'm not sure that that's the kind of samadhi I want to develop for myself. So I prefer to think of the experience of samadhi as something that's not quite so cut off, quite so removed, not so much a product of narrow, focused attention in a way to get away from the unpleasant experience of sights and sounds and intrusions, and particularly the relentless thoughts, trying to escape from those relentless mind journeys through suppression. And that perhaps there is a more useful kind of approach to samadhi, one that's broader and inclusive rather than exclusive. And Ajahn Jeff refers very nicely, I think, again, to this way of describing it, kind of the difference or how mindfulness and how sati and samadhi compare with each other, because oftentimes in some of the teachings you see that sati is described as this very broad, all-around experience that is always allowing for anything to arise. Anything is noticed and attended to with mindfulness, and that it's a very broad experience, and that concentration, samadhi, is more of this very single-pointed focus, as is often described in some of the commentarial teachings. And he prefers to interpret it, and to me it makes a lot of sense, and he bases it on some of his understanding of the suttas, that really sati, mindfulness, can be either very broad or more narrowly focused, depending on the circumstances. The four foundations, or the four establishings of mindfulness, the four frames of reference, when you look at them, they seem to have different qualities depending on what it is that you're choosing to focus on for your frame of reference for the time being, and can be tailor-made to be appropriate to the conditions of your mind, so that sometimes a narrow focus for a frame of reference is very useful if the mind is filled with some sort of obstructive mind state, some kilesa, such as, say, strong sensual desire, then one might need to have a very close focus on, say, the asubha nimitta, the sign of the unbeautiful, the unattractive, the sign of the unattractive, to help counteract that intense mind state. So that would be considered possibly a narrow focus for one's frame of reference practice, or you know, some other similar kind of antidote for other afflictive states. And then using that as needed, that narrow focus, until the afflictive state starts to dissipate, and then watching the mind being able to broaden and allowing the focus to relax and open up, and maybe move into more of a expansive frame of reference, so that it can be narrow or it can be broad, depending on the circumstances. You know, picking up a frame of reference of the breathing of the whole body, and opening and relaxing to that more broad frame of reference. But that the result, as experienced in what we would call as the refinements happen and as the mind settles down and relaxes, that the resulting samadhi that arises is always broad focused, broad and expansive. And kind of relates that to how it's often presented, say, in some of the classical descriptions of samadhi, of you know, those descriptions that I was talking about the other night, of the water being kneaded into the ball of bath powder to permeate and suffuse the entire ball little by little, with the work being done to knead it in and make it like a big ball of dough, so that the piti and the sukha that arise from that, you know, steep, drench, fill, pervade the entire body, a very broad sense, even in that first stage of collectedness of samadhi. And then the other images of the, you know, the pool of water with the flow, the you know, welling up from the bottom and permeating the whole body of water, or the lotuses immersed in a very still body of water as the concentration deepens or as the stillness deepens. And then the all-pervading light and the stillness that comes, that's similar to like being draped in a white cloud. These are all very broad experiences of stillness, of peace, that's not exclusive. So I think these images, as Ajahn Jeff rightly points out, these images are one of broad expansive experience. So it seems to me quite useful to be able to develop the ability to be open and aware, keeping the sense doors open, not in a way that allows or encourages the mind to wander and get distracted, but that isn't clamped down and exclusive in trying to annihilate fields of experience in order to attain some sort of peaceful state of mind. And that kind of ability is built on so many other factors other than just being able to sit quietly and narrow one's focus of attention onto a single object. It, you know, that ability is, as Tanisibo was pointing out, is really dependent on this development of many other factors that lead to like a kusala citta, to the wholesome mind states, so that we pick up an understanding of the teachings. We know where we're going with right view, the law of cause and effect, and the understanding that this is all aiming towards understanding and transcending the noble truths of suffering, the four noble truths, really understanding them deeply at some point. And also all the other path factors, developing the wholesome qualities of right thought, right intention, all the sila-based practices, right speech, right action, right livelihood, so that these are actually forming the basis for the truly broader state of sama samadhi. These are the foundation, the actual spot where samadhi starts to develop in the heart and the mind. That's starting to free itself from these very strong obstructive states of mind, and that as the wholesome mind develops through right understanding and sila and mind training and the right effort of increasing wholesome states of mind and eliminating the unwholesome states of mind, abandoning them, turning away from them. And the various ways that we practice with the frames of reference, various things to start to focus our attention on that help refocus the mind using wise attention rather than chaotic, unwise attention, that these are really the foundations for sama samadhi. And that the wholesome states of mind, the open, relaxed states of mind, that aren't dependent on exclusion of input from the outside world, they are dependent on the slow understanding and openness to the different mind states that we have and the shifting of attention to ones that are conducive to peace and tranquility and skillfulness, and the turning away, the gently turning away from and not reinforcing those unwholesome ones, not as a way of annihilation, but as a way of skillful redirection of attention. And then that allows for the opening of a greater sense of stillness as the mind lets go of the obstructive, chaotic states of mind that consume our attention and settle into a more peaceful, tranquil state of mind that can then see the subtle aspects of the workings of the mind, feel the gentle processes of the body as our basis, and allow ourselves to hold that openly, broadly, gently, and to absorb into a skillful object brought up through our right mindfulness. Skillfully just allow the mind to sink into, whether it's the breathing or some sort of other object of meditation, wholesome object of meditation, loving kindness, and to allow ourselves to just become one with that, based on relaxation and openness, not on exclusion and elimination. It's because we want to be there, because it feels good. So opening our doors of the senses, keeping letting them flow through, and developing that sense of stability that one can develop through letting the unwholesome qualities settle out and increasing the wholesome qualities. There's a certain stability of mind that comes from that, and if you can do that with allowing some sensory input, not excluding it completely, then it's so much more portable too. I mean, I find that stillness can be brought into daily interaction, so that you maybe have a morning up in your kuti. We have mornings up in our kutis now that we can practice. And then walking down the hill, it's so much easier if I haven't totally shut out all sensory experience, to be open to walking down the hill and allowing different visual images to come, the path in front of me, the trees and the plants and the terrain of the land, the sky, to kind of move through that still awareness, but fully aware of the sensory input or the sounds that come in, or the different sensations that come in. To allow them to move through a very still mind is a way that we can bring that samadhi into our conscious percipient experience. And that kind of stability of mind is also the mind that is very alert and attuned, or can be, to really seeing the subtle, more subtle aspects of experience, and for penetrating and examining and penetrating the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, and so that we can see, if we attune to it, where dissatisfaction, unsatisfactoriness, dukkha is arising in any moment, whether we're sitting in meditation or walking down the path or engaged in some sort of activity. If we're coming from that sense of stillness and clarity that's not exclusive, but allows us to have a very strong firming of the mind, that kind of unwavering stability, firm stability, that then can really see as dukkha arises and the reason for it, can see the craving or the and then the clinging that's happening so much more clearly, and to be able to let it go that much more quickly. And that the end result of that is that sense of becoming disenchanted with where the mind habitually turns, looking for its security. So it's that open, broad, very firm establishing of the mind that allows one to do the work necessary to over and over again, no matter whether it's engaged or unengaged in more quiet times, but to keep that stability of samadhi as the basis for seeing how dukkha arises, how dukkha ceases, and to move towards that relinquishment in any posture, in any activity. And to me, that's the benefit of how I interpret samasamadhi. It's that incredible ability to stay centered, to stay calm in the swirl of the world around us as it comes to us in our daily life, whether it's in retreat, practicing meditation more intensely, and enjoying the stillness and the peace and the calm, or whether it's more in the engaged time. But that firm sense of standing in the eye of the hurricane, that clear, calm, centered stillness that's always there, and particularly experienced the more we can develop that sense of lucid calm, so that it's calm, but it's also very lucid, alert, aware, and not exclusive. And it's based on that kind of refining process, like the refining gold teaching, where you gradually wash the all the rough stones and rocks and sand and grit out of the mixture, where there's some gold hidden, and gradually even more heating up the bit that's left, and heating up to burn off the impurities, so that the finally, after much time and gradual effort, diligent effort, that you have a very pure piece of gold, a mind that's malleable, shapeable, wieldy, and can see that the Four Noble Truths very directly, the arising of suffering, how it arises, the conditions that are there for it to arise, and how to let go of that, release that through the development of the path, all of those factors of the path, to see it clearly until one sees how to relinquish, let go, and experience the freedom of mind that's based on relinquishment of craving, of clinging, of holding. So I think I'll just leave it there for a few thoughts on sammasamadhi.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.